Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 9, 2022. We have three matters on for oral argument this morning. The first one is State versus Joyce, A20-0554. Counsel, welcome for an in-person oral argument. Just a few housekeeping notes. Matters are being recorded for later publication on our website. There's no other recording allowed in the courtroom. You each have 15 minutes for your primary oral argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name before you begin your argument and your client's name. And with that, we're ready to proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Benjamin Joyce. Your Honors, today we are asking this court to reverse the revocation of Mr. Joyce's probation because he was denied his constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel. The basis for this challenge's conviction is that his attorneys failed to raise a meritorious suppression motion that would have resulted in the suppression of all of the evidence that was used to find him in violation and ultimately revoke his probation. I would like to start first with the prejudice prong. Essentially, the prejudice prong goes to the merits of the search issue. So essentially, we are talking about, in the prejudice prong, whether the search of Mr. Joyce's home was supported by reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Can I stop you there, counsel? So I understand the argument about reasonable, articulable suspicion being absent for the probationary search of your client's home. But I'm wondering why we're talking about that when the district court expressly found in its findings that your client consented to the search and that finding is not challenged on appeal and it seems to be supported by the record. So if there's consent for the search, why do we need reasonable, articulable suspicion?
Your Honor, the consent doctrine requires development of the factual record. So we didn't litigate consent below because that wasn't argued in the state's answer. It was never presented as an affirmative defense to our challenge to the search. And it didn't appear from the district court's order that the court relied on consent in any way, shape, or form to deny post-conviction relief.
But there is quite a bit of testimony at the post-conviction hearing regarding the consent of your client from the probation officer, from both of the attorneys. Both of the attorneys stated that they did not pursue a suppression motion because your client consented. So it hasn't been raised on appeal. It hasn't been challenged. So why, again, I'm going to return to my original question. Why are we talking about reasonable, articulable suspicion when it seems like there is a pretty robust record about consent and a finding from the district court that are not challenged?
On review, this court should be reviewing the findings of the post-conviction court and the district court. In reviewing the ruling by the post-conviction court relied exclusively on the reasonable articulable suspicion issue, which was the only thing that was litigated below. So consent is something that we would litigate in the post-conviction hearing if it was raised by the state in their answer. For example, we would present the testimony of Mr. Joyce about whether he believed that he consented to the search. And then the juxtaposition against consent is whether it was a submission to a show of lawful authority.
Because that's where we're having trouble with this, it appears to be an emerging issue that everyone is trying to challenge. Not everyone, that it's becoming ripe to challenge whether or not, if you're on probation, that you just waive your right to have your property searched or your person searched. And I can see that everybody's trying to tee that up, but the problem we have here is that both of the attorneys testified that they believed he'd consented to the search. And if that is the case, and this is an issue as far as the lawyering that was involved, it seems to me a big problem to get over that testimony that they thought he'd consented to the search. And there appears to be plenty of record evidence that he did.
Whether the attorneys believed that Mr. Joyce consented to the search is different than whether he consented under the law. As we can see just from the violations alleged on their face, the first violation is the contraband they found. The second violation is that he didn't cooperate with the search.
But I mean, that's the point. If he consented to that, you're saying don't look at that issue. That issue isn't before us. We have to look at that issue because how can we even get into the merits of what you're claiming if, in fact, there is record evidence, or maybe there isn't, that he consented to the search?
Your Honor, because the consent issue hasn't been litigated below.
Well, we just don't shut our eyes to it. I mean, it's part of the factual record.
If the court believes that the consent issue could be dispositive of the search issue, the remedy should be to remand to litigate the consent doctrine because it hasn't been presented by either party and it came out almost spontaneously during the attorney's testimony. The court doesn't find in its findings that Mr. Joyce said, yes, I consent to this search. The record doesn't support consent because Mr. Joyce is submitting to the condition that he believes requires him to cooperate with the search. And as a matter of the substance of the consent issue, it doesn't support an exception to the requirement for reasonable articulable suspicion because he is submitting to what he believes to be essentially submitting to a warrant, for example. If the police show up to your house...
None of that's in the record. I mean, the record really is that probation shows up, come on in, I'm going to get you the passwords for all... I'm going to show you where all the devices are, I'm going to get you the passwords. He even calls somebody to get a password for a computer, hands over his unlocked cell phone. I mean, it sure looks like he wasn't coerced or even prompted to do anything. It seems like he voluntarily turned everything over.
If we are relying, Your Honor, on Krista Groshek's testimony, for example...
Or the probation officer or the other attorney.
Ms. Groshek testified over and over at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing, the second part, that Mr. Joyce believed that he was required to submit to a search per his conditions. So that goes against consent. Because if you are permitting the probation officers to come into your house because you believe that you have a condition that requires the probationer to submit to a search, and they show up and say, hey, we're here to search your devices per your conditions because we had a citizen complaint, that is not consent, that's submission per the conditions of release. And that's also supported...
I don't disagree with you, counsel, but none of that's in the record about that he was somehow... He felt that he was required to turn over passwords and his cell phone and other materials.
That isn't the record as much as it is Ms. Groshek's perception that he consented. That is absolutely part of Ms. Groshek's testimony, that he was under the belief that his conditions required him to submit to a search. That's, I think, probably in the pages 20, in the 20-somethings of the transcripts, is absolutely part of the record. The attorney's perception based on her many conversations with her client on what he subjectively believed was required under the conditions of his release. So his subjective belief and also on the objective basis that his conditions required him to submit to a search.
Well, the post-conviction court made a determination, a finding, that he consented to the search. And you would have to demonstrate that the post-conviction court erred in making that determination.
Your Honor, the post-conviction court's findings ultimately do say that he finds that Mr. Joyce consented to the search. But the basis for the findings are not based on Mr. Joyce saying, I consent to the search. That finding, and I'm paging through the order real quick to find this.
Paragraph 24, page 5.
I found it. Thank you, Your Honor. It says, based on the search conditions that petitioner signed in 2010 and his cooperation during the search of the residence, this court concludes that petitioner consented to the search of his home and the seizure of the electronic devices. So it's not based on his invitation of the probation officers into the house and saying, hey, I know I have the right to turn this down, and I am choosing to waive that right to turn down the search. He is submitting expressly under the conditions of release, and that's part of the district court's findings. So as a matter of law that's not brief, that hasn't been litigated before the post-conviction court, the district court, I think, is wrong based on the facts and the law because consent is different than submission to a lawful show of authority. So on the merits of consent and also based on the record and the fact that it wasn't litigated below, for those three reasons, this court should not affirm on the basis just that the district court made a finding on an issue that was not presented in one paragraph of his 30-page post-conviction order. So moving on to the...
Can I just ask one additional question just as a matter of procedure? Do you believe that we can decide the consent issue on the current state of the briefing, or do you want an opportunity for supplemental briefing on this issue?
I would accept an opportunity for supplemental briefing because it's not been litigated in any way. There's not one single case cited in either brief or the post-conviction court order, for that matter, on the issue of consent. And this court is absolutely has the authority to order supplemental briefing on something that hasn't been presented in any way, shape, or form, because I think if consent is going to carry the day in this case, then it should be briefed as far as a fair determination of the issue. It's my position that because it hasn't been litigated in any way, it shouldn't be on the court's on this court's radar for determining the issue that was actually presented to the post-conviction court.
So let me just ask a matter of procedure, too. So we're on a post-conviction motion, an appeal from a denial of a post-conviction motion or petition, and the issue is the evidence should have been suppressed, and if a suppression motion were brought, it would have been a meritorious motion. If he consented, then it would not be a meritorious motion, correct?
Because I haven't briefed it, because I haven't researched it, because it wasn't litigated below, I sincerely don't know. I understand that the consent doctrine generally acts as an exception to warrantless, suspicionless searches, but I would have to research it. I would have to brief it to give a determinative answer on whether I can candidly take a position on it, because I don't know, because it wasn't litigated below. And, you know, your honors are familiar with the law as judges, but as far as litigating or deciding issues that were actually litigated by the court below, that was the purpose of the stay of remand. This court repeatedly, even in Anderson, the case that talks about whether searches are protected by reasonable suspicion, declines to answer the question of whether the search condition was even valid because it was raised for the first time on appeal. This court and the Supreme Court always say, if it's not raised below, if it's not litigated below, it's not going to be part of the issue that the Court of Appeals is deciding.
I mean, that's sort of the point of my question. So when we're generally deciding the merits of a suppression motion, it's a de novo review based on the record. And if we see some legal basis for the search to declare the search valid or invalid, then generally we would accept that regardless of whether it was raised.
I respect your Honor's position on it. I also think that because it hasn't been briefed in any way by the parties of the court, like I do think that supplemental briefing could be appropriate if that was dispositive of the other issues that were thoroughly briefed and extensively raised below.
I'm
just thinking procedurally at the district court level, typically if a prosecutor is saying this evidence should come in and there wasn't a warrant, they will say it should come in for these exceptions, is my recollection of being a district court judge and a prosecutor.
Your recollection is correct, Your Honor, and you can review the state's answer or the post-conviction memo that they filed after the hearings or even arguments or inferences made during the post-conviction hearing that would have put anybody on notice that consent was going to be on the post-conviction court's radar, that the attorneys spontaneously, you know, express that they believe consent was one of the bases that they considered. That's not the issues raised by the lawyers litigating the case. So, you know, fair notice and development of the record are very important on review. I think this court has a well-developed body of case law acknowledging that. So de novo review, of course, does permit the court to look at the existing record to see if the search is valid. But I would urge this court to restrict its review to issues actually litigated and raised by both parties. because that's what this court does in every case. The other issue, if this court is as concerned about the reliability of the tip, is whether the law is well settled. In my remaining minute, and perhaps going into rebuttal, it is important to consider the body of case law, both at this court and in the recent unpublished cases in the past couple of years, and also the application of Anderson and the United States Supreme Court decision in Knights, which all uniformly apply the reasonable suspicion standard. So the only reason that the district court ultimately concludes that the attorney's performance was not deficient for failing to raise the issue is because it believes that the body of law is unsettled. I would urge this court to read Anderson and Knights closely, and not just the sections that talk about the search themselves, but the sections that precede those issues. For example, in Anderson, when the Supreme Court is talking about declining to reach an issue, it's talking about whether they declined to reach an issue of whether the reasonable suspicion that lower expectation of privacy applies in the absence of a valid search condition, because the preceding issue was whether the search condition was in fact valid. They declined to reach it. I see that my time is up. I'll raise the remainder of this issue on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Wow, this is angled. May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler. I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'm here asking this court to affirm the post-conviction court's rulings in this case. I'll turn first to the court's questions regarding consent. And the district court did, based on the record that the parties developed, find that he had consented, finding 24. The court then, in its conclusions of law, also found that there's no prejudice because any such motion, had it been brought, would have been denied because he consented. So that was part of the record at the district court.
It wasn't specifically litigated, and it certainly wasn't raised by the state on appeal.
Correct.
So I wonder whether we should... I wonder what your position is on whether we should remand the case to the district court for specific findings with respect to consent, or to develop a more robust record with respect to consent. And then I'm also interested in your position on supplemental briefing, counsel.
I think that the time for that would have been in the district court, in the post-conviction court, when we received that order. There was no surprise to us, the parties that were there in the courtroom listening to that testimony, that that's the record that was being developed and was developed. Both Kendra Siminski, I'm sure I'm pronouncing her name incorrectly, and Krista Groshek testified about consent. So there was plenty of testimony and evidence about consent. So had the parties been unfairly surprised by the district court ruling, a motion for additional briefing or for reconsideration certainly could have been brought in the district court at that time. There is no reason for a remand at this point for further development on that issue.
Well, let me ask you about the pleadings that you filed in district court. Did you say the search was okay because Mr. Joyce consented to it?
No. I did not.
Did not raise that as an affirmative defense or reason, basis for letting the evidence in.
Correct. Correct.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I did not, Judge. But the time, had the defense wanted to litigate that or felt that the district court, the post-conviction court, had clearly erred by doing that, the time to do that would have been after we received that post-conviction order.
I'm trying to find the conclusion of law that says that consent made it a lawful seizure.
It's under the prejudice discussion that there is no prejudice.
Could you point me to a page?
I can in a moment here. So it's in the post-conviction court's order.
Because you will agree that the most of the legal discussion or conclusions of law have to do with whether or not reasonable suspicion was required and whether or not there was reasonable suspicion.
Correct, because that's mostly what appellant had raised and was litigating. If you turn to page 27 of the district court's order, first full paragraph, because reasonable suspicion supported the search of petitioner's residence and devices, this court would have denied any suppression motion had petitioner's trial counsel brought one. Based on the conclusion that Hennepin County Probation conducted a lawful search, one, and two, this court's finding that petitioner likely consented.
Well, likely consented is different than what I would have found as a district court judge.
That's the record.
Likely doesn't quite get you there, I don't think.
That's the record we have on consent.
Thank you.
Turning to the other issues, the question, all of this is filtered through the ineffective assistance of counsel lens. And so first, the district court, the post-conviction court found that there was not ineffective assistance because suspicion was not specifically required to support the search in this case. And the district court, post-conviction court, surveyed the cases and came to that conclusion based upon the specific conditions in this case, the specific probation conditions that authorized random searches. And that is entirely consistent with this court's case law, really all of the cases. And when you look at it, there seems to be inconsistency in this court's prior cases dealing with this issue. But when you actually go and look at what is the Court of Appeals and Minnesota Supreme Court addressing, it comes down to what are the conditions of probation or parole in that given case.
Let me just ask, is it your position that reasonable articulable suspicion is not needed for a probationary search?
Yes.
So your position, excuse me, is that you can have a suspicionless search?
Yes.
Of a probationer?
Yes, absolutely. And this court's cases say so.
What's your best case that supports that proposition?
Really all of them. I mean, if you look at it, starting with Reyes says that you can do exactly that, even though the rest of that decision is contrary. It says that random suspicionless chemical tests are completely constitutional. There need be no suspicion. So in the cases that...
Well, I was on that panel, and my recollection and reading of that case was that we interpreted Anderson to require, and I'm quoting now, the search of a probationer's home to be supported by reasonable suspicion.
Yes.
So it goes on. I understand your argument.
So it goes on, and it finds that suspicionless chemical tests are completely constitutional. It does make a finding or find that you need to have reasonable suspicion for search of the probationer's home, relies upon Anderson, and relies upon, in that case, the state's agreement that that's the case. That's not what Anderson holds. And as the post-conviction court in this case says, Anderson holds that reasonable suspicion is sufficient. That doesn't mean that it's required. So Reyes finds that you can have random searches. Maybe Reyes in particular did not say if somebody's home because the prosecution agreed that you couldn't. But it did find that it was appropriate for chemical testing, which is a search. So
are we distinguishing then between, when you're talking about the probationary terms, aren't we distinguishing a search to ensure compliance with a term, like be free of drugs, not consuming alcohol, versus a Fourth Amendment type search that is broader than that and could produce evidence of a new crime? I mean, are we at that point where we should start distinguishing? And maybe that's what our case law has done.
I think that the most you can say is that Minnesota cases, under the totality of the circumstances, look at, was the search reasonable? That's at the base core what the law is.
But isn't there, what I'm getting at is a distinction in the search. You know, it's a search of your person to see if you're consuming alcohol versus a search of, I mean, do you understand what I'm
sure, and so under the totality of the circumstances, is it reasonable?
Well,
so,
isn't it a reasonable suspicion?
That goes into whether it's reasonable, as does what are the probationer's terms and conditions? Did they agree to it? Are they required to agree to it? And in this case, they did agree to it. So
I don't think they have a choice whether or not they're going to agree to it.
They absolutely have a choice. They can take 144-month downward dispositional departure and agree to these terms and conditions or not. In this case, he
not
did.
Not really a choice, counsel. I mean,
they made the same argument in Drake that it's a contract of adhesion. Nevertheless, that goes into, is this a reasonable condition? And in this case,
the choice is either sentence executed or accept something lesser than execution of the full sentence with probation. So if you want probation, this is what you're giving up.
Absolutely. And that is completely reasonable because we're letting this sex offender into the community. We want to monitor. We want to make sure that they're complying with their search conditions. Under the totality of the circumstances, under the reasonableness, you look at what does this person have as a reasonable expectation of privacy and what should they have as a reasonable expectation of privacy. As a probationer, it's reduced. Everybody agrees on that. You look on the other side for the state, and what are the reasonable expectations for the state to have for probationers? Drake talks about it is an interest in public safety to ensure compliance with probation, even for sex offenders. And even if it is a significant invasion of their privacy, they have an extremely limited privacy right.
Drake was decided under Eighth Circuit law, which is a little different than Minnesota law.
Well, not necessarily. Minnesota says that it follows federal law, and Drake was, number one, applying federal law, but two, looking at Minnesota law since the search occurred in Ramsey County.
Well, Minnesota law also says that we grant greater protections than the federal constitution.
But if you look at Anderson, it specifically rejected greater protection under the Minnesota Constitution for probationers. And if I might, Drake discusses that there's not, and it might be easier for the federal courts because they do see a variety of jurisdictions coming before them instead of typically just one jurisdiction as Minnesota does. But Drake discusses how all of these are different. You can't compare. It's not that there's probation is probation is probation, and similarly parole is parole is parole. They all have and can have different terms and conditions placed upon them. Some are more restrictive, some are less restrictive. So under the totality of the circumstances, you look at what do they have for conditions in this case. That's the Fourth Amendment. Drake explains it and specifically looks at Minnesota and says Minnesota does not have this blanket rule requiring reasonable, articulable suspicion for testing. It just doesn't.
So assume that there is a reasonable, articulable suspicion requirement for a probationary search of a home or a computer or a cell phone. Is it your position that that existed in this case?
That it existed if we do have that?
If there was reasonable, articulable suspicion for the search based on this tip?
Oh, yes. Then yes.
And what is that when the tipster expressly states that she has no basis to prove or she can't prove any of the allegations that she is making?
And the district court discusses exactly that and explains why that doesn't diminish it's not mere whim, caprice, or idle curiosity. It doesn't have to be probable cause. We don't have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. It's reasonable, articulable suspicion.
But what about this email, which is what we have in the record, is anything other than a hunch, which is not reasonable, articulable suspicion.
The relationship of the parties, number one, and there was more than just the email. There was the discussion between
the relationship between Pam and the person who allegedly saw this contraband on the computer.
Yes.
And the testimony in the record about that is just that they knew each other, or they were close.
Yes. And then the testimony came in that this is not a stale tip because sex offenders typically keep pornography on their computers for long periods of time. Both case law supports that, as well as Groshek's testimony supports that, that her clients do that. We also have all of the evidence that the district court discussed in why that is a tip that does, that have elevated this beyond mere whim, caprice, or idle curiosity. The court does not seem convinced by that.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, she says the ex-wife told, you know, it's sort of like my best friend's sister's girlfriend, right? So it's my, you know, the ex-wife tells Pam, who tells the probation officer, and then disclaims all of it by saying that I've got no proof of any of this. So I'm just trying to get over the what about that is something different than our case law that says that that's a hunch.
Both attorneys who represented Mr. Joyce in the district court testified in the post-conviction that that disavowal of the making the report did not diminish the credibility to them because it was just saying, why would the sister admit to the brother that, yes, I turned you in?
Because he had sex with her daughter?
Right.
Might be one reason.
But that doesn't diminish the credibility of the tip.
And it's through an ex-wife who probably isn't his biggest fan either.
But they're identified, which goes to, I mean, we know all of this. And the question is, was it ineffective assistance, number one? And then we haven't talked yet about, and I have 25 seconds left, the trial tactics. The district court find that this was a valid trial tactic to not focus on this percolating issue that they didn't believe was even valid because he did consent and because they did have reasonable suspicion, even if it was required, which they didn't believe it was. So for all of those reasons, I would ask this court to affirm the district court.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Your Honor, I'm thinking about cases where the state may have raised potential or failed to raise dispositive issues on, for example, the search. One recent example is Bilbro. There's this rule following the Coles decision that as a matter of law, draws a distinction between the Rule 27 remedy and the post-conviction remedy. Bilbro is a case where the state failed to file a cross petition for review, and that limited the scope of the Minnesota Supreme Court's review of the actual validity of the sentence. Part of the robust discussion during oral argument in that case, for example, focused on, you know, the court essentially probably would have not granted relief had the state preserved that dispositive question of law. So Your Honor is correct. In this case, the state hasn't raised this essentially affirmative defense that, you know, consent might be an exception to the otherwise requirement for a search supported by reasonable suspicion. And because the state has not raised that at any stage here, not even in the responsive brief to this court, it's simply not a basis that this court can affirm on. So if this court believes that there's not reasonable suspicion, if this court agrees that the attorney should have filed the suppression motion, then Mr. Joyce was deprived his right to effective assistance to counsel based on the issues that were preserved below and briefed for Your Honors. Because just as the state had ample opportunity at the post-conviction level to raise it in their answer, they also had ample opportunity to raise it in their responsive brief, which would have prompted us to write a reply, which we didn't do in this case. Replies are reserved for new issues that aren't raised, that aren't, you know, specifically addressed in the principal briefs.
Can I turn your attention to the tip itself?
Yeah.
So we have an identified tipster. We have an identified source of the tip. And typically when we look at our case law about informant information, that when we can trace the source of the information to a person who's identified, we generally presume the reliability of the information that is provided to law enforcement. So what about that case law makes this this tip unreliable?
I'm relying on Navarette in my brief that provides Your Honors with a number of factors to consider. So, yes, you know, Miss Pam, the tipster, is identified. She's identified as an individual who's made the tip. But just the anonymity of it, or lack thereof, is not dispositive here. It also goes to the reliability based on whether the tipster actually had firsthand knowledge or otherwise had a reliable basis for the tip. There's also problems, in addition to what Your Honors have also already observed, that she, when pressed, says, I don't have proof. I don't have firsthand knowledge, and I can't tell you how the person I heard it from knew. This is juxtaposed against the factual, the facts of Anderson.
But when you trace the source of the information, she did identify the source of her information. And so law enforcement, hypothetically, could trace that information back to the ex-wife.
And that's where the corroboration fails, Your Honor, is that they didn't. They don't. The probation officers who conduct the search don't follow up with Pam. The probation officers don't follow up.
Do they have to under our case law?
When the tip itself is not sufficiently reliable, they are required to investigate just like they did in Anderson. Anderson is a good example where the officers sought out corroboration. It was not the defendant's girlfriend that made the tip. It was the defendant's girlfriend's mom. Right, but the mother provided specific information that provided law enforcement to follow up. The Anderson case specifically identifies corroboration as the basis that I'm asserting that they do need to follow up. Because when the tip is as vague as this, when the tipster backs off when they are asked to provide additional details, when they refuse to expose themselves to law enforcement. Because the email specifically says, asked if she went to the police. She goes, no, I didn't do that. I don't want to call the police. I won't accept the phone number for the actual probation officer.
She did show up in the probationary office 2 days
police.
Later.
Police. Oh, you're adding an additional fact, Your Honor. Not correcting me, I understand. She did show up in person, but would not follow up with law enforcement. I mean, yes, there's the allegation for the sexually explicit materials, but there's also the way more serious potentially allegation that he's stalking the victim of his case, which would actually be a crime under the violation of the Danko imposed in this case. I see that my time is up. I ask Your Honors to reverse the revocation of Mr. Joyce's probation or otherwise submit supplemental briefing on the issue of consent.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, your arguments and your submissions were very helpful to us. Thank you very much. We'll take the matter under advisement. And act in due course. Thank you.